The panel is open for questions. If you could go to the mic so that we could be sure to hear you, and it would also project for the videotaping purposes. Questions for any of the panelists? First of all, congratulations to this panel, and actually, as I sat here thinking about it, to all of the presenters today. It's really exciting to see nursing research that has moved to such a point of tangible benefit to the health of our nation. But Alexis, I could not let you go without asking for further clarification on that phenomenal 3% follow-up that you were able to accomplish, and I'd love to hear a little bit more about how you managed that.
You mean how we lost so few?
Yes, right. So few lost to follow-up, yes.
Well, what Claire Ann suggested we do from the very beginning is that she told me a fact I didn't know, which is that the post office only keeps forwarding addresses for 6 months. And so what we do is they're getting their questionnaires annually, and then on the six-month anniversary, we send a newsletter. We use a consistent logo. They know all about us, and we do know all about them, too. But so with that, we've captured these address changes, and I'd say about 5% of our sample moves every year. It may be the same 5% that are moving, but so we've been able to keep track of these folks. They call us and tell us, and they drop by sometimes. I didn't mention these folks are from around the state of Texas, so it's a fairly wide geographic area.
But great accomplishment.
Thank you.
I enjoyed all the papers. I have a quick question for Dr. McSweeney. How did you classify appropriately the healthy women to make sure that they weren't just undiagnosed heart disease women?
It was self-report. We did not go in and do that. There's always the possibility with prodromal symptoms that they could be undiagnosed. And that's part of the reason in our new grant that we're following women for 2 years is because usually the very longest period of time we ever saw people experience prodromal symptoms was 2 years, and so that's why I picked that time frame. But there's, you know, I cannot tell you that none of those women had any kind of impending heart problem.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The lady in pink was next.
Sure.
Hi, I'm Teresa Panyas from George Mason. I also have a question for you, Dr. McSweeney, about the individuals who were healthy but had chest pain and had a negative cardiac catheterization. Would the individuals who had prodromal symptoms, if they experienced the test, would that have been positive? Did you have any data on that?
You're asking me about the women in our study?
Right. In other words,
if they had cardiac CAS and were positive?
Well, no, what I'm asking is, suppose you said there was a group of people who had chest pain, but they were healthy. They'd get a test and it would be negative. Would you find that the patients or the individuals who had these prodromal symptoms, which were rather vague, did they have a test and was it positive, or did you have any of those data?
We do have some of that. I did not bring any of that with me. A lot of the women were not diagnosed before they actually had their MI.
I see.
I couldn't tell you what percent, but I would say probably a third or more had been to physicians, and some of those indeed did have cardiac CAS, and some of them were diagnosed.
So in other words, are we assuming then that absent frank chest pain, the likelihood of having a cardiac cath is low? I mean, could you say anything about that? Suppose I just had very vague symptoms. Would I have a chance? What probability would it be that they would say I needed this test? And, you know, the fact that it could be diagnostic.
First of all, let me say that right now, in order to get a cardiac cath, you almost have to experience some type of chest pain. When I was talking with the physicians group, they said we can pick up some of these early prodromal symptoms that you're talking about, and we have a suspicion that women may be experiencing early symptoms of heart disease. But due to the criteria that we have with insurance companies, in order for insurance companies to pay for a cardiac cath, chest pain is the criteria that we look for. We do know that if you go back in the literature, and I'm certainly not going to do this, but there's lots of literature that says that chest pain is not a good indication in women, and we still continue to look for that. Insurance companies continue to require that, and that's part of the problem. I mean, it's a multifaceted problem, and we have to approach this from many different ways. I do want you to know that some women do appear very classic. Some women do have acute chest pain. Some women look very much, you know, like if you pulled out a textbook and read about heart disease, they look like that, but a lot of women do not look like that.
Well, it's my hope then that your work will lead to some change in those diagnostic criteria. Thank you.
Thank you.
First of all, so that there is no question, I am 6'3", without shoes, just in case you're wondering. So I'll lean down to talk to the mic. I just have a couple of comments. I'm from Greenville, North Carolina, and I came to this conference for the first time with actually four intentions. And those intentions are based upon four hats that I am assuming. The first hat being that I'm the vice president of nursing for an 850-bed hospital. So it really was good to hear the presentations today to talk about how I could potentially help in breaking down some of those barriers for getting nursing research within hospital organizations. The other hat is that I'm a second-year PhD student, and so it's really good to see all of you experts in the room, as well as networking. I've had a number of conversations with all of you, all the way to Patricia. I've stopped her a couple of times, and she's been so graceful in answering my questions and giving me people who I should follow up with after this conference. The other hat, of course, you're pretty obvious, is that I wear the minority hat. And so to hear Dr. Sweeney talk about, and Dr. Jammet, who talked really, really fast, all black women do not talk that fast, I have to tell you. But to hear that presentation was really good for me, because again, it gives me an opportunity, because as much as I want to do research, I also want to be able to contribute to my culture as well. And so that was good. And the last one was, again, a novice researcher. And to hear you all talking about things, and that I know just enough right now to be dangerous when people are defining things like reflexivity and that sort of thing. But just, again, on behalf of, from a student perspective, thank you guys for the opportunity to participate, and it's been really, really good.
And for someone your height, stand tall and wear a big hat. There was one other question.
And I'm not 6'3", but I came from Greenville also. My question is for Dr. Moore. In your reference to the change in the math cognitive abilities, were the assessments that you did based on their ascending school age or based on their baseline at the time of the original assessment?
Thank you for asking. And are you talking about the neuropsychovals or how we place them for intervention, or both?
Both.
Okay. I work with a neuropsychologist, Dr. Christine Kamik, and we use a standardized neuropsychological battery. So, for example, the Woodcock-Johnson is a standardized measure of looking at academic abilities. We use a visual motor test called and verbal fluency. So they're standardized measures that give you norms. Most of them have a mean of 100, standard deviation of 15, and we track within individual change over time. With regards to the intervention, and thank you for asking that, we use something called Key Math, which is available from the ages of 5 to 14. And so we recruited children as young as 4, knowing in this study, although we've learned we should start earlier, by the time they reached the age of 5, we could enroll them. And the Key Math is a way to evaluate a child's analytic abilities on skill, not age. And so the intervention was based on skill and not age. And so we could place children anywhere along that line, but we had to stay within the age of 4 to 12, so that by the time they finished the study, they would still be within the range of the measure.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Oh, yeah, sorry.
Dr. Moore, I'd like to know how you trained your math interveners. First of all, did they have to be math majors, and how did you train them and keep them in your study?
Again, I was very fortunate to work with Cynthia Anhold, whose PhD is in math curriculum, and she worked with me to develop the intervention. We then recruited our intervention people at both sites, And while we looked for someone who had an academic background in working with children, which we did, we also did intensive training with them in terms of, I mean, we have manuals for, you know, that are very specific, not only in terms of the activities and the manipulatives, and then we videotaped with parental permission to make sure that our intervention delivery was consistent and across both sites. So we really tried, our goal was to get someone who had worked with young children who could understand delivering interventions related to analytic abilities. I want to just, can I just add something, because I know it's Phoebe who does siblings. We had sibling controls in our study, and we didn't present that data. And I was talking with someone at lunch about siblings, and I have to tell you that every IRB report I made for an adverse event was a sibling. And it had to do with depression, suicide ideation, and mutilation. And across the two sites, we had 10 or 12. All of our adverse events were siblings. So what I thought would be a really good control group turned out to create its own unique challenges, and I'm sure you know about that.
Again, I thank you all for your perseverance in staying to the end of the day. I believe Dr. Grady would like the microphone, or since she's behind me.
Thank you all. We are at the end of our very exciting day. It's hard to imagine that it took 20 years to get here, and it's over so quickly. But it has been a fabulous day, and we're really very happy that all of you could be part of it. I would like to thank everyone who has participated in this wonderful event, both on the way to get here and throughout the day and throughout the coming year when we will continue our celebrations. I would especially like to, many people have helped, but I would especially like to thank Dr. Mindy Tinkle, who is in the back still organizing and making sure that everything is on target for us today. And next to her is a partner in crime, Chuck Sabatos, who is the chief of our Office of Information, Science Policy, and Public Liaison, who has been part of this overall effort and Mindy's partner in crime, and made sure that everything, as he said, everything that looks good, that was my responsibility. So, thank you, Chuck. I would also like to thank all of the moderators and panelists for such an excellent program. Your presentations and discussions address some really incredibly powerful and important research. Work that deals with a number of issues that are core and essential to our mission. Overall dealing with work that deals with life and death decision making, as we started out today, preventing health disparities with cutting edge technologies this afternoon, but also hold great promise for relieving and avoiding suffering and pain for all of our population, as well as the creative approaches to symptom management that we've just heard about this afternoon, that also will help in health promotion and increasing quality of life, so important to our mission. I would like to say that basically what we've heard about today are successful projects. It's work that addresses important public health problems and issues, also informs practice, very important to us, and also will provide the building blocks for the future work that will be done from legions of investigators beyond us. So just in closing, I would like to say it's amazing. There's a lot that we've done so far, but we really have a lot yet to do. We've made great strides, and yet we have a whole future that is open before us that we need to build on and fill with really good work. So we do have a lot. The future awaits us, and we have a lot to look forward to scientifically and professionally. It was only, if you think about it, it was only 5 years ago that we were facing a new millennium and thinking about what that would offer and what that would mean. It's hard to believe that that's actually 5 years ago, but it really was a time when we were anticipating the future with a sense of infinite possibilities, great unknown. And even at that time, we were still aware that our science was still unfolding, but we knew we had made significant contributions to the overall healthcare practice and also to patient-oriented research. We knew that ever-changing trends and the rapidity of science, progress and breakthroughs that we're making will continue to keep us on our toes as we generate new ideas and projects to meet new challenges, such as the nature of science. But now, a brief, or for some instances a longer, 5 years later, we do continue with the progress and the excitement of the work that is ongoing and the work that is yet to be unfolded. Next year's symposium, we will be dealing more directly with the and exploring what the future of nursing research is going to be. You have seen the seeds of that today, and we'll be building on today's program. But what we'll be doing really is trying to address questions such as, what are the key issues that face us as we look to the future? What are the opportunities that we're likely to be looking at? Among these, the increase of aging in our society, the increase of aging in minority populations, the continuing shift from acute to chronic illness, the rapid pace of high technology, how to incorporate that, what to do with it, how to make the best use of it. Also, one major one which we've heard about today and which we will continue to incorporate is that of genetics. The pressing need for new strategies for home care, promotion of health, both at home and throughout our communities. The prediction and prevention of disease and providing high quality palliative care for the dying. All of these are issues that we know we will be dealing with, and how they will play out is yet up to us to determine. Further, how can we capitalize on multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary research? This is something that we're very good at, and it's something that we have a lot to teach others who are now recognizing the importance of these approaches and looking to us for leadership in that area. Most important, how can we effectively translate and transfer our research results into healthcare practice and into policy to benefit patients? Nursing research is by design and by necessity quite broad in its scope. And we're fortunate to have, because of that, we are fortunate to have an abundance of opportunities for creativity, dedication, productivity, and achievement. And we are fortunate to have the talent to address those opportunities, but we must continue to foster and encourage that talent. We've heard from some of it today, and I know that there are students in the audience. We really must work very hard to keep the talent that we have and to foster new talent and foster its growth. I am confident, thanks to the vitality and the resilience of nurse researchers, that our science will deepen and expand and make a significant difference to the healthcare and the quality of life for all of our peoples. Thank you again for making today's event so memorable. The future awaits us, and I know that you all will be a major part of helping to make it interesting and memorable as we face it together. Thank you all very much.